Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
A few weeks back, we featured a panel discussion on religious liberty and economic growth that was hosted by the Religious Freedom Project at the Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs at Georgetown University. That panel was part of a broader symposium held back in mid-November of 2016 and involved a number of other panels devoted to the consequences of religious freedom. Today, we bring you one of the other panel discussions, this one focusing on the question of whether religious liberty can be an antidote to religious extremism. The discussion was moderated by Thomas Farr of the Religious Freedom Project and now director of the Religious Freedom Institute, and the panelists, in order of appearance, included William Inboden of the University of Texas at Austin, Dan Philpott from the University of Notre Dame, Alan Hertzke coming from the University of Oklahoma, and Sahar Aziz, a professor in the law school at Texas A&M University. We hope you enjoy this panel discussion, and for more information about the Religious Freedom Project, the Religious Freedom Institute, and the scholars involved, we invite you to visit our website for more information and web links.
We're now turning to the question of violent extremism. And we all know that we have a serious problem in the world with violent extremism. The phrase countering violent extremism has become so important that it has its own acronym, CVE. If you haven't heard of it, you should be proud of that, because that means you're not a member of the intelligentsia, the chattering classes, or for the academy, or the policymakers. I just spent 2 weeks ago a few days in London at a conference on countering violent extremism, which was sponsored by the Foreign and Commonwealth Office of the United Kingdom. And what they wanted to do was ask the question that we are asking in this next panel, and that is there a relationship between countering violent extremism and religious freedom? Being in the business that I've been for the last several years, you know, it's one of those foundational questions that I find myself wondering why people are still asking, but they are. And indeed, there was a great deal of resistance to the proposition that countering violent extremism should have any reference to religion at all. And so this is one of the things that we're going to talk about in this panel, because while there are many violent extremists, and I dare say there are many that have nothing to do with religion, and there have been throughout history, certainly in the 20th century, the most violent extremists were the ideologies of communism and Nazism. They both wanted to destroy religion. Today, when we talk about violent extremism, we tend to talk about ISIS and Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, other groups that associate themselves with Islam. Of course, there are other violent religious groups in the world today. There are violent extremists that are Christians. There are violent extremists that are Hindus in India. And there's a group that many of us have never heard of, violent Buddhist extremists. So this is not about one religion, but it is about the question of whether we can discuss religious freedom, this is part of what we're going to talk about today, with respect to violent extremism, without using the word religion, except in the phrase religious freedom. And in the United Kingdom, they tried to get many of the speakers tried to do precisely that. It was a wonderful contortion to witness. Religious freedom is this freedom of belief, going back to what Peter Danchin was talking about a a few minutes ago. And there are, you know, there are people that have these beliefs. There are all kinds of beliefs. And in fact, the European expression of what we are talking about as freedom of religion is called freedom of religion or belief. And that's got its own acronym, FORB, which is, I've told them that for that reason alone, they ought to get rid of that phrase. You need an attractive acronym that you can trip quickly off the lips. The problem, in my view, with FORB is that it reduces religion to a form of opinion. Because belief is such a huge vessel, what does it mean? But religion ought not to be such a huge vessel that we cannot identify it when it exists. So what we want to do with this panel is talk about the issue of whether religious freedom can be understood as part of the battle that we all share against violent extremism, and whether it is legitimate to speak of violent religious extremism, or in the case of ISIS and Al-Qaeda, violent Islamist extremism. So in order to talk about these and related questions, we have a sterling panel, and I'm going to introduce them briefly to you now, and then I'm going to sit down. I'm not wired, so I'll just have to shout, if that's okay, unless somebody wants to bring... Ah, you've got it there. Okay. Can you wire me while I'm talking? Is that possible? Okay. Good idea. Let them talk, and then you can wire me. Let me introduce them from this microphone, though, and that'll do well. So I'm going to start down at the end with Professor Dan Philpott, who, and Dan, I'll ask you to go first when we begin. In fact, we'll just come across this way. Dan is a professor of political science and the director of the Center for Civil and Human Rights at Notre Dame. He's also an associate scholar with the Religious Freedom Project. He specializes in the relationship between religion and politics, and in particular, Catholicism's contributions to freedom and democracy. He's participated in faith-inspired reconciliation efforts in some tough places around the world. He's the author of many books and articles on religion and international affairs, but I've said this to Dan before, of all the splendid things he's written, to me, one of the most trenchant and one that I've used for years in my classes, and in fact I think is relevant to our discussion today, although he's written a great deal, is an article for the American Political Science Review called The Political Ambivalence of Religion, in which he talks about how to think about the way religions develop their own understandings of what he calls political theology, and in fact how each one of them becomes associated either with violence or with more democratic values on the one hand. If that's a fairly good, you have to nod because otherwise you'd have to explain why I got that wrong. I think it's pretty good because I've been, it's very helpful in framing the way that we're going to talk about this. Dan is also writing a book for the Religious Freedom Project on Islam and religious freedom. Next, William N. Bowden, who's executive director of the William Clements Jr. Center for National Security. He's an associate professor in the LBJ School of Public Affairs and distinguished scholar at the Robert S. Strauss Center for International Security and Law at the University of Texas in Austin. I don't know if you were insulted by Senator Sass's reference to Texas earlier today, but I certainly hope so.
J School, so he should know better.
Yeah. He should know better. Okay. Right. And, of course, he knows you too, Will, so he should know better. That's precisely why I insulted Texas, I'm sure. Previously, Will N. Bowden served as senior director on the White House's Strategic Planning of the National Security Council. He was a member of the Policy Planning Staff of the Secretary of State, which is sort of the think tank of the Secretary of State. And he was a special advisor in the Office of International Religious Freedom at the Department of State. He is the author of another book that I use in my courses, and it's a wonderful book called, a work of history. He's a historian by training, Religion and American Foreign Policy, 1945 to 60, semicolon, here comes the punch. It's really the it gives you the thesis of the book, colon, The Soul of Containment. So, what did religion have to do with the development of the American doctrine of containment during the middle of the Cold War under the presidents Eisenhower and Truman? Alan Hertzke is David Ross Boyd Professor of Political Science at the University of Oklahoma, Faculty Fellow in Religious Freedom for Oklahoma's Institute for the American Constitutional Heritage, and Presidential Teaching Fellow in the Honors College. He's also an Associate Scholar with the Religious Freedom Project and co-chaired the Christianity and Freedom Project, which I mentioned in my remarks earlier this morning. I want to say that Alan has written the definitive work on the coming of something that has been behind what we've talked about today, and that is the International Religious Freedom Act of 1998. It's called Saving God's Children. Right, Alan?
Freeing God's children.
Well, that's an important distinction that I should have gotten straight. Maybe is that what you call a Freudian slip? I'm not sure. Freeing God's Children. Fantastic explanation of the coalition of religious and non-religious groups that came together to pass this act, as well as the anti-trafficking and the Sudan Act during the turn of the century. Highly recommend this book, and Alan, delighted to have you with us, as well as Will and Dan. Now, as in the previous panels, we have someone who we are delighted to invite to engage in this conversation. And I'm not going to put Sahara Aziz on the spot to suggest she's going to disagree. I have a feeling these three fellows that I've introduced to you are going to manage to disagree with each other. They better. But Sahara Aziz is professor of law at Texas A&M University School of Law. You may have heard her ask a couple of trenchant questions earlier in the day. Before then, she was adjunct professor at Georgetown University Law Center, where she developed and taught a new course entitled National Security and Race in a Post-9/11 America. She served as a senior policy advisor for the Office of Civil Rights and Civil Liberties at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, where she worked on public policy involving the intersection of national security and civil rights. She's litigated class action suits on civil rights and has conducted a human rights investigation on child trafficking in the Middle East. What a fascinating portfolio for someone who is also a professor of law. She's written eloquently on many subjects, but has been especially critical of American legal and state institutions, and I hope I'm articulating this right, the stigmatization in particular of American Muslims in the way that it has carried out its national security policies, and perhaps some criticism of non-governmental groups as well. So as you can see, this is a magnificent group to bring together to talk about the question of religious freedom and violent religious extremism. So let me begin with Dan Philpott. And Dan, and then we'll just come across and talk a little bit about how your work has informed this issue and whether you see relationships between religious freedom and violent religious extremism. How do you think about that? How do you talk about it?
Well, I'd like to speak a little bit about Islam, because Islam is often associated with violence and religious violence. And you mentioned that I'm writing a book on religious freedom in Islam, and that's the core of my work as part of this project. So the kind of popular image that Islam is associated with a lack of religious freedom and with violence is, you know, there is a lot of truth to that as an empirical pattern. Islam has a disproportionate low level of religious freedom. If you look at the 47 or so Muslim majority countries, less religious freedom than the rest of the world on average. Also, Islam is some 90% of the religious terrorist groups are Islamic and is a disproportionate share in religious civil wars. So you find empirically the broad global pattern, both low levels of religious freedom and high levels of religious violence. But I think the picture, though, is a little more complex than to simply say that Islam is, you know, directly responsible for the violence. One of the things I'm finding in my work is that there are two patterns of Islamic countries that lack religious freedom. One is very familiar, religiously repressive countries. And this would be like Saudi Arabia and Iran and, you know, pretty straightforwardly Islamist governed, and they do things to foment religious violence. But more surprising to many is also the prevalence of what might be called secular repression, where in Muslim-majority countries, you have governments that are really modeled on a kind of Western French Revolution style governance, which involves a very heavy management of religion. Again, we can't just equate the West with religious freedom, because there's the whole tradition surrounding the French Revolution, which is then imitated in countries. The standard bearer is Kemal Atatürk's Turkey, which its regime still today is really built around this heavily secularist model. Atatürk had very ambitious plans to kind of remake the soul of Turkey and Turks in a secular kind of Western image. He thought that the way of the future was nationalism, science, enlightenment, rationality, and so forth. Nasser followed suit in Egypt in the early 1950s, and then many of the Arab countries are on this model, as well as the Stans, that group of Central Asian countries, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and so forth, are all belonging to the secular repressive pattern. And I would argue that both of those patterns of governance tend to promote and foment religious violence. Should I explain how, or should we go on?
Well, let's go through and then come back. And okay. I would like you to explain how, but you've talked about both secular and more religion-oriented forms of repression. I think it's important that we follow up on this aspect of Muslim-majority countries, which, mm-hmm. of course, we're aware. And I particularly like a little bit of French bashing. As part of every panel, we try to do that. We've certainly done it here. Okay.
Bien sûr.
Yeah, okay. Professor Inboden.
All right. I want to start taking up this question from the vantage point of recent history, drawing a little bit on my background as a scholar, but especially my status as a recovering policymaker, I suppose we could say. So I joined the State Department shortly after September 11th, actually working with Tom in the Religious Freedom Office, and then from there went over to the National Security Council and was able to work on this collection of issues, religious freedom, human rights, counterterrorism, counter-radicalization from a number of vantage points. And we just passed, of course, the 15th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. And if you were to have told me shortly after the 9/11 attacks, that we'd be sitting here 15 years later with three realities, I would have been surprised at these three realities. So what are the three things that I have been surprised about in the 15 years since? The first, which really needs to be said, is that the United States has not been attacked again on a large scale, another large mass casualty attack since 9/11. Many of us here in the room, many of you here in the room were here in Washington that day, or perhaps New York, as was I. And you remember the environment in the weeks and months after the attacks. I mean, it was just sheer terror. And we didn't wonder if we were going to get hit again. We wondered when we were going to get hit again. And the fact that 15 years later that hasn't happened is notable. And I think any discussion about fighting terrorism and the ongoing threat needs to begin with that fact. I think it's certainly a tribute to the Bush administration and the Obama administration, both of whom have had very vigorous counterterror policies. But the second surprise for me about a reality 15 years later after 9/11 is that today there is this proliferation of violent jihadist groups. I know the terminology lexicon itself is problematic, and we could talk about there. There's no perfect way of describing it, but I'll use that as a placeholder right now. After 9/11 is really just core al-Qaeda, but now we've got the Islamic State, you've got al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, you've got al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, you've got Boko Haram, you've got al-Shabaab, any number of others. This whole menagerie of jihadist groups that have proliferated, showing us that the threat is still out there and that the appeal of this particular ideology and the movement to terrorist action that it inspires, the threat is still very real. So that also would have been a surprise to me. And then the third surprise would have been that 15 years after 9/11, the United States as a government and even perhaps as a country would still not have an effective counter-radicalization policy and not have an effective set of instruments to prevent further radicalization. And that is actually a religious freedom problem. And that I think the very fact that it's a surprise to even call it a religious freedom problem shows how impoverished our thinking still is on this. Tom, you know, if I recall, what made your hair go gray and made me go bald was, you know, our first couple of years there in the IRF office trying to put some of these concepts in 2003 and 2004 in some of the early International Religious Freedom Reports, talking about this is not just a boutique, feel-good, human rights, humanitarian issue of helping a few prisoners of conscience around the world. Rather, this is a strategic imperative to promote religious freedom, to promote religious pluralism and tolerance as antidotes to violent extremism, militant Islam, whatever we want to call it, and the fact that we haven't made more headway since those very early days of even trying to introduce those concepts into our government is really discouraging, and we still haven't cracked the code on how and why. You know, a very tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of the world's Muslims, and that really needs to be remembered. That's why some of the, you know, the rhetoric out there blaming, you know, treating Islam itself as a problem, I fiercely reject. Islam, in a lot of ways, is going to be the solution to this. Yet the fact remains that a tiny but still very troubling percentage of the world's Muslims, or converts to Islam for that matter, are being radicalized, are seeking to take up arms and harm women and children and other innocent civilians and blow themselves up in the process. And the fact that we have not made more progress on that is very, very troubling. And we can talk in the discussion about why I think that is a religious freedom problem. But I think that is acknowledging that that is the problem is the beginning to wisdom in tackling it. So.
Great. Thank you, Will. We'll come back to exactly the point you were talking about, which I think is at the core of what we want to get at today. So, Professor Hertzke.
Well, for at least a couple of decades, I have sort of immersed myself, both as a scholar and as a participant and observer, in the world of religious freedom and advocacy and persecution and so forth. As a social scientist, what I find striking is that I think we are at an historic moment in which the sort of philosophical and normative claims of philosophers and thinkers and religious leaders for centuries about why religious freedom, conscience rights, freedom to follow your transcendent duties is inherently a good thing is now actually being corroborated by massive social science research. And one of the key findings, Will Inboden's research, Lace Sayes, a number of other people involved in the Religious Freedom Project, is there's a powerful causal relationship documented with global data, sophisticated methodologists, corroborated in numerous ways, of a link between religiously repressive societies and states and religious violence, civil wars, religious terrorism, interstate conflicts. It's one of the most powerful relationships I think I've seen in the social sciences. It's almost nomothetical or law-like, and like a law of physics. If you repress this fundamental human dimension in a variety of ways through favoritism, restrictions, mob violence, and so forth, you're going to produce religious violence and instability. And I thought I'd just share with you one of the most dramatic findings. So we have now, this is interesting to me, we actually now have global data. Very good quantitative data, not just the Pew Restrictions reports, but global terrorism databases, polity scores. We have tremendous amounts of global data, which enables us to actually test these theories. So of the 289 international terrorist acts since the Cold War, 3% originated from religiously free societies as defined by Pew Restrictions reports. 8% from moderately restrictive states, and 88% from religiously restrictive states. And this figure includes international terrorism from a variety of religious actors, whether Islamic, Hindu, Sikh, Muslim, Jewish, Christian, etc. Every conceivable terrorist incident that the vast majority come from or originate from religiously repressive states, and the targets are predominantly those same societies. So the targets of religious violence, 68%, 69% of religiously repressive states, 24% moderately, and 7% religiously free states. So clearly, religiously repressive measures produce religious violence. And so what we know, in a sense, is that the great challenge of the 21st century, intense religious commitments, religious diversity, and religious violence, a key antidote, or perhaps the key antidote, is reducing that religious repression. To me, it's striking.
Or to put it more positively, advance religious freedom, or move in the direction of religious freedom. Right. So when we come back, Alan, let's talk a little bit about, you know, the positive correlation, what we can say about that. If it's true that religious repression causes religious violence and extremism, obviously there's something going on in any country there where whether it's secular or religious or whether it's dominated by it. How do you crack into that problem? And, you know, can it be done by the State Department, which is, you know, a question I've been asking myself for about 20 years now. Can anything be done by the State Department? No.
You want me to wait
it's
on
too
that?
Too far. No. Not. That's too much. All right, let's hear from Professor Aziz. It's great to have you with us.
Well, first, thank you for inviting me. It's nice to be back in D.C. So I wanted to make kind of 3 points and then perhaps debate them or unpack them later. But I found your comments to be interesting because the literature that I've been reading and has been, particularly the political science literature, is that no one can find a direct cause for terrorism. And there is, now I'm focusing on terrorism, not just religiously motivated violence. So terrorism is when there's no universal definition. There's a big debate because you get back to your freedom fighter versus terrorist kind of binary dispute. But to the extent that terrorism is motivated by social, political, or religious ideology that seeks to coerce a population or influence government policy and directs the violence at civilians. So with that very generic definition. And there are many debates as to whether the cause is poverty, political repression, human rights violations, which falls under that, economic conditions. And so I wanted to just put that out there as everybody's looking for that silver bullet, and there have been different empirical studies. There has been a study by, I think, Alan Krueger in the West Bank Gaza, where they showed that, in fact, many of the suicide bombers were educated and were not kind of these completely disaffected, impoverished individuals. But then there's another study in Pakistan of, I think, 200 people who are either part of a terrorist organization or have engaged in terrorism themselves. And they found that poverty and marginalization and political humiliation or revenge seeking from state violence was a big kind of correlation. So I just want to put that out there when we're trying to determine the role of religious freedom. The second point is I think we maybe inadvertently cabin religious freedom from other types of freedoms, and I think it is connected to political freedom, from freedom of speech, freedom of expression, assembly. It's not feasible to have a society where you can have religious freedom but not other types of individual freedoms. And so to the extent one's priority is religious freedom, I think you're going to have to deal with all the other freedoms because it's really the context in which religious freedom thrives or is able to be supported. And when you were talking about these countries, I appreciated the fact that you highlighted secular authoritarianism because you're right. That tends not to be. We tend to focus on Iran or Saudi Arabia or Hezbollah or Al-Qaeda, but we don't look at the military regimes and we don't look at the monarchs and all of the other different types of regimes that are governing over a Muslim-majority country, but they are not Islamic governments. They are not run according to Islamic law or Islamic. They're not Islamic in any way. They're just Muslim-majority, and there's a difference. So this is a Christian-majority country, but it is not a Christian country. That's how I would analogize it. So I think we need to be looking at authoritarianism and the role of authoritarianism in producing terrorism, of which a subset is religiously motivated, or when you use religion to justify what I think is politically motivated violence. And then finally, I see terrorism, whether it's in the name of a religion or in the name of some secular ideology like communism, Marxism, socialism. I see it as a form of resistance to state violence or to societal changes that people find to be unacceptable, oppressive, offensive. And I think if we can understand that it, in a very bizarre sense, it's a rational act, even though it's not something that we find to be moral, then perhaps we can start finding ways to channel the rational grievances in ways that are nonviolent. But as long as you have a society in which violence is the currency in which you engage in social control via the state, then the response from the non-state actors is going to be violence as well. It's all in there.
All right, terrific. Well, maybe we can turn to each of the three, starting with Dan, and you can address the theme that you started, I think, Dan, and respond to Sahar very well here. Let me just repeat her three points. No one can find a direct cause of terrorism. There are many: poverty, political repression, marginalization, human rights violations, the revenge culture. Surely that's true. And the second point is religious freedom is connected to all of these other freedoms, and perhaps I'm going a little beyond what you said, but maybe there's a higher, illegitimate hierarchy here. Alan may want to speak a little bit about that. I mean, they're connected. One should not be put in front of the others, if I understood what you're saying. And finally, terrorism is often a form of a reaction, resistance to state oppression. So maybe we can just come down and the three of you can respond to this and bring in your own points as well. Dan, you first.
I think Alan's and Sahir's insights are reconcilable in a sense that Alan is presenting these very interesting findings that regimes that repress religion tend to breed religious violence. Right? By the way, this is also the finding of a dissertation student of mine, Nile Saya, who is wanting to publish a book or having a book, you know, being published, really presenting the same finding. And he has broad data patterns that are showing this, I think very powerfully. But let's remember, as Sahira said, that regimes that repress religion are not necessarily religious ones. They may be something like Saudi Arabia or Iran or what have you, but it could also be a secularist regime or, say, a communist regime, you know, like, let's say, China, North Korea, Vietnam, and so forth. They come in many varieties, or a religiously nationalist regime, like in India in some ways. In the Islamic world, one of the things we see is this pattern of secular repression. And I can think of at least three examples of secular repressive governments that bred something like a civil war, something close to a civil war. I mean, I think of Algeria in the early 1990s when it canceled the military government, canceled the election results, and where, you know, an Islamic party had won the election. And rather than allow it to govern you know, make its mistakes and so forth, but it very much canceled the election and so forth. So you had a civil war ensued that resulted in something like 200,000 deaths. You know, Tajikistan, right after the Cold War, did something similar as kind of secular-minded government, very repressive of Islam, ended up producing a major civil war. And then I think Egypt in the late 1980s and early 1990s, Mubarak launched a kind of major crackdown on Islamic parties and groups of a very wide variety, not just the kind of hardcore violent extremists, but a very wide kind of crackdown, and that resulted in a kind of very wide, high levels of violence. So I think that this pattern is something that, you know, is very important to note.
Okay. Just one follow-on there. General El-Sisi in Egypt today.
Yeah.
A realist, an American realist, is going to look at this and say, well, this has solved the problem. You know, all the violence that you talked about seems to have gone away. The Muslim Brotherhood has gone away. How do you fit that into your...
Yeah, I would not expect that to happen. Certainly, maybe in the short run. He's, you know, in some ways, you know, the Morsi government was very problematic, more from the religiously repressive angle, but his crackdown has been massive on the Muslim Brotherhood, and I think that I would expect it then to kind of result in more instability. I mean, to his credit, he's given protection to Coptic Christians and so forth. But you know, this is a secular repressive government, and I think the kind of findings that we've been sharing and discussing today would suggest that this is not a long-term sustainable solution. By the way, just one more insight. So I have a chapter in my book on the Arab Springs, and I don't think it should be called the Arab Spring anymore. I call them the Arab Uprisings because they turned out not to be a spring, something like a winter. I mean, all except for one, arguably Tunisia, all of the uprisings did not result in a democracy. Almost all of them are less religiously free now than they were then.
Right.
And Tunisia is the one model where I think it's made some strides towards religious freedom and towards a kind of contested democracy. Not without its problems, but that's interesting. That's where it started. But I would argue, this is just the punchline, is I would argue that in all these cases, the problem, the reason why it didn't succeed, was in some way a lack of religious freedom. Either from the religiously repressive angle, the secular repressive angle, or some combination in which they feed off each other. I think that's what we're seeing in India and in Egypt. We went to religiously repressive, and now we're back to secular repressive.
So the realist assumption that we're in good shape in Egypt is probably a fool's bargain at this point.
Yeah, the realist needs to understand the importance of religion and religious freedom for long-term stability.
Yeah.
And to truly be a realist, I would argue.
Okay. Did you want to respond to that, and then
just
we'll go to Will?
Egypt is a country that I study in depth. Yeah. So I think that what Sisi is doing is breeding the next generation of terrorists in Egypt. I think that he's laying the foundation, unfortunately, for an unstable future in terms of the political instability. And we're seeing signs of that in the Sinai. There's very little coverage of the Sinai by design because he's imposed a blackout, media blackout. But there are reports that many of those who were on the Muslim Brotherhood side of let's use the political system in order to gain power are now going to the violent route. And those in Sinai actually had made many public statements saying, you fools, we told you not to go the nonviolent route because you're in the same place we are, in jail or dead or tortured or being chased by the security services. And I just want to point out, and I tend to be somewhat of a minority perspective on the Egyptian assessment, particularly by my colleagues who live in Egypt. I didn't see the Muslim Brotherhood. I don't think they had a chance to be repressive, and I don't think they have the power to be repressive. They were starting to appeal to the Salafi right because the secular left were so angry at them that they started pushing them hard and they pushed them to the right. And they were too weak to turn that place into a theocracy. Moreover, the people didn't want a theocracy. Egyptians are devout, but they don't want a theocracy. And I saw the Muslim Brotherhood as the opportunity to show that being an Islamist opposition is really easy, but being an Islamist government is not, and they were probably going to fail. And that was going to kind of turn a new page in Egypt and other countries and showing that perhaps religion is better left to the private space because they don't have this panacea that they're claiming to have because they were using religion to claim that we're going to fix corruption, we're going to fix all these social problems, and the reason why Egypt is suffering is because it's lost its way. The Egyptians are no longer as religious as they should be, which, by the way, there are many people in the United States who say the same thing with regard to Christianity and social mores here. So I see a lot of parallels between that. But
okay, I want to hear Will and Alan on this, but I want to throw one more ringer in here for the realists that I think we're going to be seeing here soon. Or people who fancy themselves realists. China has been very effective in doing what some think Sisi is doing. It's a very different system. But there are growing religious groups in China. China seems to be very, very stable, thank you. Maybe not in economic terms or in other terms, but with respect to its capacity to repress, it has shown an amazing resilience. So I just want to throw that in, and if you care to comment, fine. Otherwise, Will, let's hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I'll try to, I guess, put out some thoughts or provocations on three themes, and we can, again, come back to them, so I won't go in depth. But on the autocracy and secular government theme, I'll very much echo the other sentiments shared on Egypt. Short-term stability is breeding long-term instability. And again, this has been a recurring pattern going back to our support for the Mubarak regime, who's the current head of al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri. What nationality is he? Egyptian. Again, he'd been early in involved with the Muslim Brotherhood, was imprisoned and kind of further radicalized under the oppressive Mubarak government in Egypt, and now is leading Al-Qaeda, who may be making a resurgence pretty soon. So I'm also not optimistic about the trends we're seeing with Al-Sisi. And these are difficult trade-offs, because sometimes if the choice is short-term stability or short-term instability and violence, then, you know...
Right. Governments are short-term institutions.
Yeah, but we always seem to fall into the short-term mindset, and then that does create some of these larger long-term problems.
Right.
But second, to expand a little bit more on how and why I do think religious freedom can be an antidote or an ameliorative to radicalization, to violent jihadism. You know, the first is obviously a constitutional order and a society that has the cultural and constitutional protections for religious pluralism is just, it's creating the habits of peaceful coexistence and of differences being resolved through peaceful means. It doesn't expect everyone to believe all the same, but it's this is where, you know, I very much echo Professor Aziz's comments that we still don't really know what causes a terrorist. But Peter Bergen has just finished a really big study of every known incident of domestic homegrown radicalization here, and he finds that he crunched all, 368 cases or whatever. He found there is no common denominator here. People go these pathways for very different reasons. And yet we do know that, by and large, going back to the macro data that Alan was sharing, that societies that have legal and cultural protections for religious freedom foment much lower levels of radicalization and violence. But the second is, going back to my comment about Islam being the longer-term solution to countering violent jihadism, protecting religious freedom, the ones who benefit the most will be the vast majority of the peaceful Muslims out there. I don't want to use the term like moderate, because moderate and extreme, I think, are too subjective. But they often, the ones who speak out against violent jihad, the ones who speak out against intolerance, are the ones often most victimized. You know, I often have to remind friends who get worked up about this that the, just in sheer numbers, the largest victims of violent jihadism in the world are their Muslims, much more so than non-Muslims. And so empowering and supporting those peaceful and reformist voices, that's a religious freedom question. It equips them to speak out from their own interpretation of the faith against the extremists. But finally, just three thoughts, three reasons why I think the United States government as an entity still has not made this fundamental connection between religious freedom and counter-radicalization. The first is ideological. I do think that there still is too much of an unwillingness to admit the religious roots of a lot of terrorism. And even though the terrorists themselves will tell you they're doing this out of religious motivations, for me it just starts with that self-evident fact. Listen to what the other guy says is his motivation. Take it at face value. But we have this kind of pervasive secularism in the national security establishment that just won't even admit there's a religious element to this. It's not a good religious element, but it still is a religious element. The second is bureaucratic. Those few instruments in our government who are tasked with promoting religious freedom are, Religious Freedom Office at the State Department stuck underneath the Human Rights Bureau, whereas our lead entities for combating terrorism are mostly in the Defense Department and the intelligence community, with a little bit of a diplomatic element at state. But they're just too bureaucratically separated. They inhabit almost different bureaucratic universes. And the third one is the practical one. It is really hard to promote religious freedom internationally, period, let alone in some of the environments where it's needed most, which is either a very strong, repressive, authoritarian state that doesn't want this at all because it sees it, because religious freedom is a bundled commodity of other freedoms, and here I'd very much echo Professor Aziz's point, because religious freedom encompasses freedom of assembly, freedom of conscience, freedom of speech, freedom of association, all those other things. That is anathema to the dictators out there. But then let's look at the other contexts that arguably need religious freedom and religious pluralism. It's the weak and fragile failed states. It's Yemen. It's Syria, if we can even speak of Syria existing anymore. It's Iraq. Well, it's just, we've learned it's very hard to create good governance and a stable order there, full stop, let alone embedding constitutional and cultural protections of religious freedom. So even though I'm sitting up here now as the snarky professor saying all the things our government's getting wrong, it is really, really hard to do it. My concern isn't that it's so hard and we've tried, it's failed, that we've tried and failed, is that we haven't even tried yet. So.
Can I hear an amen? Sorry. That just slipped out. Alan.
I think that There's tremendous hope, actually, in the findings of research, and I would say events on the ground, which is why I come back to, I actually think we're at kind of a liminal moment where we haven't caught up with the reality of our own insights. But because the world is more thoroughly religious than we ever thought it was going to be a century ago, and because we're more diverse and cheek to jowl with each other in a way we never would have imagined, we actually have to figure out a way to live with one another. I mean, in a shrinking world, live with our differences in a shrinking world. And it does appear to be the case, and I think we need to explore the causal pathways. In other words, what kinds of dynamics operate in societies where people with different religions are treated generally equally and there isn't favoritism? What happens in those societies? People channel their energy in more positive ways. Dissenters can articulate. They can reform their own faiths. Majority faiths become less militant, and so forth. So we need to look at the causal pathways. What's happening in religiously free societies? What's happening in religiously repressive societies to produce these powerful outcomes? What I find fascinating about this research is that it obtains even when controlling for democracy. In other words, the illiberal democracies are as conducive to or incubators of religious violence as authoritarian regimes. And some hybrid or authoritarian regimes that have regimes of broad toleration, maybe not full religious freedom, but some broad toleration, actually are less incubators of religious violence. So we might reprise Immanuel Kant, you know, the famous thesis, how do you get perpetual peace? Well, democracies don't go to war with other democracies, so if all societies are democracies, you'll have perpetual peace. And I think Saez's research suggests that it's not a democratic peace. It's actually a religious freedom peace, in the sense that that is the ingredient that seems to undercut the militancy, the grievances, the cycles of violence, the exporting of instability, and so forth. So to me, that's a pretty profound finding and a hopeful one. And I don't know how the American government can promote religious freedom. I'm not sure I know how to do that or how the government. But there may be a modeling effect over time as countries that succeed demonstrate this is the way you become successful economically and politically.
Terrific. Well, I want you to respond to him, but if you, in going back and thinking about and elaborating on your three points, Sahar, the issue, your second point, religious freedom connected to the others, Will, I think, helpfully agreed with you on that. But I wonder if you were making a point so much about interconnectedness, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that you feared, as I think I said before, that religious freedom was being viewed as superior. And in fact, there is an argument. If you listen to Ben Sasse, his speech today, he didn't use the word superior. No one ever would. But it's the first freedom, as our founders understood it. Foundational in a sense that it is not in the sense that it's superior, but it's, it energizes the others that you spoke of, freedom of association, freedom of speech. All of these things that are in the First Amendment, let alone those that come afterwards, including his idea that government has enumerated powers. Government is only that which has only the power given it to it by the states and the people, which itself is in part a product of our First Amendment, he would say, I think, and in fact did. So would you, as you talk about your second point, would you hit on that? And then on your first point, which was that no one can find a direct cause of terrorism. Will, again, said, he sort of did it as assumed, you have to ask the terrorists what their motives are. And the answer to that has to do with religion. How do you fit that into your first point here?
Okay.
But I also say what you wanted to say about... the other stuff.
Well, so first I should clarify.
Do this in 3 minutes, please. No, just kidding. Take all the time.
Well, first, I wanted to clarify that I when I talk about religious freedom, it wasn't so much that it's considered superior; it's that it's not being connected to all the other freedoms. That okay. I don't think that you can have one without the other. One of the
so Will was right.
Well,
I was just putting you back saying you were right.
Yeah,
so that's
right.
Then you're right. Okay. So, for example, going back to Egypt, one of the measures that Sisi took, which I couldn't figure out if it was a public relations stunt to appease the Americans or if he really thought this was going to be effective. But when he took power, because of, you know, he obviously put the entire Muslim Brotherhood in jail or and did many other things that were human rights violations. But then he started to take control of the mosques because there was it was quite a free market. And when it came to imams and many mosques where people, just private citizens, the community would select them and they could lead the prayer and they weren't necessarily part of the Ministry of Awqaf and the state institution. And now they have sermons, Friday sermons, that are sent to all of them. And they say, I'm not sure if it's verbatim. I've heard that it's getting more and more close to being verbatim. It started out with, here's the topic of your sermon, and if you don't talk about this, then we are going to shut you down or persecute you in some way. And you had to now be certified, so all of these private citizens could no longer be imams. So they've bureaucratized religion since Sisi's come in, and I think it's because he doesn't want anyone espousing any kind of religious viewpoint that could have a political angle vis-a-vis the regime. So I bring that up to say that if you can't have the moderates go and debate the extremists, which of course is a very subjective term, what's extreme in one society is different than another, so I acknowledge that, but you can't have that debate if you don't have an environment of open debate. Mm-hmm. So what I find fascinating and somewhat irritating about American policy or Western policy is we're very good at pushing for secular political free speech, but we don't realize that you need both. You need to be able to debate theological issues as well as secular political issues, and you have to have it, and you can't do either without an open environment. And what will happen is sometimes the governments abroad will say, well, we'll let them talk about this, but we won't let them talk about that, which is connected back to what you said, because there are certain topics or certain groups that have very real possibilities of being political opposition. So if they're weak, we'll let them talk, and then we'll tell the Westerners, look, we're relatively open. We're not as authoritarian as you say. So I just... It's really a policy recommendation, frankly, is don't create these silos. It all has to be together. The secular civil society is just as important as the theological or religious civil society to create that open environment. The other point I wanted to make, and someone touched on it on another panel, which also the research shows that the problem are the transitional periods. It's when countries go from, you don't just become a democracy. You have to go through a transition, sometimes more painful than others, sometimes longer than others. And that's when the country is the most vulnerable to being sabotaged or hijacked by extreme groups. If you are in a part of the world where religion is the most prevalent or most common ideology, then religion will be what will be used. If it's Marxism, if it's communism, if it's capitalism, I mean, pick your ideology. But in the Middle East, for better or worse, it is going through a religious wave starting in the 70s, after the post-kind of colonial era, where religion is a very common belief system, although it's interpreted very differently and there's all kinds of sects and everything, but religion is a common cultural value. So they're going to use that in order to mobilize people. And so I'm sorry, I just lost my train of thought.
Well, that's all right. I think you're making a very important point here. And if I could boil it down to the way I see this, is that religious people are, in many of these countries, are not allowed to speak openly, to express.
Right.
I would call that religious freedom. Some call it free speech. But when you're talking about religion, your own religion in particular, blasphemy laws often are standing in the way of these things in Muslim-majority countries. There's still blasphemy laws in other countries, too. And historically, they've been a problem.
Sorry,
yeah,
I just
go ahead.
Make it. So what happens is during the transitional periods, for example, there'll be a political Islamist group that's very far on the right, and it will take advantage of the political space and the insecurity and the ambiguous situation, and they'll mobilize people and they'll mobilize them in ways that will perpetuate the authoritarian way of governance, but this time religious rather than military, or religious rather than secular. So then you have the seculars going, no, we don't want the one vote, one time, and then we can't get rid of the Islamists. So that's the fundamental problem. It's this transition period, and how do you get through that hump and not let the Islamists or the communists or the capitalists or the secular elite or the military, whomever it is, use that to say, okay, now we're going to take power and throw democracy out the door.
I thought we had gotten rid of the communists, but I guess not. Dan?
You never know.
In Tunisia is an example where you had a better outcome. I think exactly as you say, in Egypt, you had the problem with once the Brotherhood came into power, they had to rule in coalition with a Salafist who had won 24% of the vote. And so it's partly the reason why Morsi had to make a lot of these kind of Islamist statements was to appease the Salafist coalition. But also, just as you say, the kind of secular forces were not willing to then kind of, you know, cooperate and go in a coalition. And so he was really walking a tightrope, one that he could easily be pushed off. By contrast, in Tunisia, you also had the fall of a long-standing secular repressive government, Ben Ali, but you had the Ennahda party come in, which is an Islamic party. And it didn't have to rule in coalition with the kind of hardcore Islamists. It did go into coalition with the more secular-minded, and you had a pretty successful transition to democracy. The most important test was that a few years later, after they had had a lot of difficulty in government, and like all governments do, and they weren't very well trained for democracy, they lost the election, and then were willing to stand down. So it wasn't one vote, one man, one vote, one time. They were willing to stand down and allow another. In fact, they were shooting off fireworks. They were so happy to, you know, they were celebrating the election. And so so I think there's an example of, the possibility of Islamic democracy.
We want to turn to our audience now, so I'm trying to signal to the people with the mics. There we go. Have we got two? All right, good. Any final points before we turn to the audience that you want to make? Okay. All right, this lady here, and then we'll go to... here's your mic coming behind you. If you would, state your name and affiliation, if any, and then state your question.
Okay. My name is Ilhan Kagri from the Muslim Public Affairs Council. Hello, how are you? I have two quick comments and a question. So the first comment is that I work on a human rights report card. And when I was doing the work on Algeria, people were saying, well, a lot of human rights advocates and religious rights advocates were saying, look, the priests in Algeria do not get government salaries, whereas the Muslim imams do get government gas salaries. Well, the reason they do that is because they become government workers. And then the khutbah, the weekly sermon, comes directly from the government, and they do not have freedom of speech in the mosques. So the priests rejected that salary just for that reason, so that they would have freedom of speech in the churches. So in terms of who doesn't have rights, I think it's a little bit, it's debatable in that issue. The second thing is that in terms of CVE work in the United States, both law enforcement and the American Muslim community have reached a consensus that the way to fight extremism and radicalization, which actually occurs mostly online, is to open up the mosque space and to make the space, the mosque, a space where vulnerable youth can come in, have open discussions, actually talk about, you know, some of these crazy ideas, and then have other people reason with them and tell them why this is neither religious nor ethical nor practical. And so this has turned out much better. People in this space have come to the conclusion that opening up the discussion is actually much more beneficial in terms of fighting extremism than the crackdown, which is exactly what you people were alluding to. And then my question finally is to Sahar, and that is, if we're not, actually to anybody, if we're not able to find a root cause for terrorism, is it not maybe because the definition is wrong? That the definition is actually taking a bunch of actions which don't necessarily fall in one category. We've pooled them all together, and then we say, okay, all of these things are going to count as terrorism, and here we should look for a root cause for that terrorism. So one of the questions that I have, for example, is I served briefly with the Army, and we were told that terrorism is this very specific thing and that it has to include an act against the U.S. government. So when I asked about Timothy McVeigh or the Unabomber, no, those people were not terrorists. I assumed that was because they weren't Muslim, but no, they were not terrorists because they did not. It was not an act to overthrow the government. And that whenever a Muslim did it, it was clearly to overthrow the government. So that was very, very surprising to me. So could you speak on that, please?
All right, well, let's start with Sahar. If I could just rephrase the question. Is the problem the definition of terrorism, or is terrorism something that we can agree on. We know it when we see it. And we need to talk more about the problem. And this issue of root causes, I mean, sometimes it begins to sound like a silver bullet. Is there one cause? What I'd like to focus on is the extent to which, and we've already talked about it, but just as we go through, the extent to which we can impute, we need to talk about religion as part of this, or as the current administration would have it. If we do that, then we're recruiting for the bad guys. So let's start with you.
Okay. So there is no definition that anyone agrees on, which is a reflection of the fact that there's a problem. My personal...
Of terrorism.
That there's a problem in terms of how we define it or fail to define it. My personal opinion is it's a type of crime, but it's highly politicized, and it tends to be used often based on the political environment, whether political circumstances such as the identity of the perpetrator or the identity of the victim or the type of motivation of the actor. I think one way to kind of solve this is to perhaps do away with terrorism and create multiple types of crimes that are specific, like bombing an airplane or a bomb, you know, bombing a government building or assassination, or you know, and just breaking it down, because terrorism now, whether it was purposeful or not, is a very political term as opposed to kind of a formal legal term. So I am agreeing with you that it's a problematic term. I'd rather just say it's a crime and it's a certain type of crime and then disaggregate it.
May I, just before you move on, what would you say, what would you call what ISIS is doing?
Well, what I see ISIS is a non-state, well, they think they're a state, they're militants, and they're fighting for a state, and they're fighting a war, I would say asymmetrical war, except unlike al-Qaeda, they actually have a military, and they have military equipment. Now, do I think they're legitimate? No, I don't. But what I think ISIS is doing is more traditional warfare and engaging in, and as it does it, it violates the rule of law and it violates human rights and it arguably is engaging in genocide. So I see actually ISIS as different than the more like al-Qaeda's and those who are not in a quasi-state environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think it gets, but when you're talking about, for example, let's use al-Qaeda for example.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're more traditional non-state insurgents, militants. I don't want to use the word terrorist because if I use it, then I'm just perpetuating this problem. I would rather say they've engaged in, for example, murder,
mm-hmm.
Or they've engaged in hijacking an airplane, or they've engaged in, and that way they have engaged in those crimes, and these are domestic and international crimes.
Right, right.
And so you have to ask yourself, why would you, I'm sure many of you instinctively are thinking, no, it's terrorism, call it terrorism. Why? I mean, it has a connotation, a cultural connotation, and we want to condemn it, but I think murder is also condemnable. But you
the role of religion in explaining it.
So I'm not a theologian, so I don't, I'm not qualified to engage in a theological discussion, and I think it's better for someone who is more well-versed in that. But from my perspective is when I study these different groups, yes, they are using religion to justify their violence and their criminal activity. But if you go and look to how do they recruit people, who do they recruit, how do they continue the movement that they're trying to create, it is often based on things like the various things we talked about, poverty, unemployment, humiliation, maybe a family member got killed by the police, they've been tortured. And yes, there is a small group that you'll call them the purely ideological, but I haven't yet seen evidence that those are the majority of people. That's just how I tap into your grievance. And many of them have mental health problems as well. And finally, I'm doing something that I always warn against, is we're aggregating. I really think there's a big difference between those engaged in, I'll use terrorism for lack of a better word, in Sinai is very different than Syria, is very different than Iraq, is very different than Algeria, is very different than the Basque region. And one of the problems we have with terrorism is it decontextualizes everything. And so we try to use this one word to define very complex, different problems where perhaps one of the consequences of these problems is violence.
Okay. Alan, you're nodding your head over there. Don't tell me you're going to
agree.
Well,
first of all, I really like the thrust of the question, which or the comment and the question, because that's a really awful definition of terrorism, if that's the definition they were using at the State Department, or the military, rather. But the idea that you need to open up spaces is precisely right. I mean, the research suggests that where people can discuss, debate, dispute, challenge their own faith or other faiths or so forth, it tends to diffuse the militant theologies, and militant theologies tend to come out of environments where you have outbidding, where the militant groups can sort of outbid the state for being even more militant than maybe the theocracy is, or putative theocracy. So I think that's exactly right. And I find that the term religious violence is actually useful, or religious-based violence, because I think scholars have suggested that religious terrorism or religious violence is actually more resilient, more ruthless than other forms of politically motivated violence, which might be ameliorated by actual political victories or concessions and so forth. And so it's a uniquely destabilizing.
More tenacious.
It's more tenacious. It's uniquely destabilizing in the global environment right now.
Sort of the reverse of spiritual capital.
And, yeah. And so in that sense, we need to focus not just on this vague thing called terrorism, but really religious-based violence. And it could be communal violence, it could be civil wars, it could be terroristic activities, insurgencies, transnational operations. But it is a uniquely destabilizing aspect of our globe today, and therefore we need to look at what creates it to ameliorate it.
Well,
a few thoughts which are partly in agreement with what's been said, but partly in disagreement as well. Since if we all just sit up here and agree with each other, then you have no...
Just leave.
Agree that definitions are hard, but I still like to take a stab at them. So my working definition of terrorism generically has been use of violence against civilians by non-state actors to achieve a larger political or religious goal. And there's some subcomponents of that, but those are, I think, the distinctive marks. Sometimes that means it's an act of war. Other times it means it's a crime. And sometimes it's in its own little nebulous world there. And again, with say, the problem of violent jihadism, again, realizing all these terms are problematic, the beginning of strategic wisdom is realizing that, yes, there are a lot of very particular differences among the groups, and some of them have more global ambitions, and others are much more localized. You know, Boko Haram, a lot of it is localized. But at the same time, it's clear that there are some commonalities why we can talk about this, in some ways, this family of groups. And so what's ISIS doing? Well, what ISIS is doing in Iraq and Syria right now is essentially waging war to try to defend their incipient notion of a state. But what does it have to do with Orlando or San Bernardino or Paris or Brussels or Nice? Well, the terrorists who committed those crimes slash acts of war, again, you know, there's a little bit of both, saw themselves as acting as part of a much larger ISIS cause, as identifying with this this you know rather perverse caliphate they've set up. And so I think we can't understand those acts, those terrorist acts in you know those other cities outside of the Iraq-Syria orbit without understanding that the actors, the terrorists, do they see themselves as being inspired by ISIS, in some ways directed by ISIS, and part of the larger ISIS cause. And so, again, I think we need to understand that if we're going to be able to address and combat it.
Dan, you want to add something?
If no, not to this. Yeah.
You know, I want to add something to what Will said, please. Because Will's own research, which you didn't cite, has suggested that the very definition, the self-definition of the jihadists is in opposition to religious pluralism and religious freedom, that that's their self-identity. It's not incidental. It's the direct identity that they want to create a religious uniformity in a diverse
and,
world.
And use violence and coercion to impose that religious uniformity, again, right. Which is anathema to religious pluralism.
Please.
So I have a question for you, because you know, those who are in the West, the foreign, what we call the foreign fighters, I kind of see them a little differently than those who are either trapped under ISIS's territory or have, in fact, joined them voluntarily or perhaps due to coercion, but as opposed to those who are in the West. And there's been a lot of, now, these are mainly anecdotes or case studies of trying to understand who are these people. So many of them, there seems to be a common thread that they're not very religious. They don't understand Islam. These are not young, many of them are young men who, for example, were raised in very orthodox Islamic Muslim families and went to a very orthodox mosque and read the Quran multiple times and then decided, you know, this is what I must do to go to heaven. They often are lost youth, have identity crisis, sometimes mental health problems. Perhaps they went to prison and I hate to use the word radicalization because the American side of me thinks being a radical is a patriotic thing. So I don't like the word. But they transitioned into using violence for whatever their motives are. So I think this is where it gets a little bit sticky is, and this is where I start to question as a non-theologian, the role of religion in terms of being the substantive motivator versus just a tool. It's just a way, you're upset, you want to act. How can I convince you to act and keep acting in a very high-risk activity so I will find religion?
Quickly, Dan.
Yeah. I was going to say, I think what you're saying is right about the recruitment and those who join it may not be kind of deeply religiously minded and so forth. But I think that still is a very powerful ways ISIS has a kind of deep theology that shapes the group and that motivates the group and that the people are then kind of socialized into. I think there is much that ISIS has done that cannot be explained apart from theology. There are ways of treating religious minorities. We heard from a Yazidi earlier. And there was a New York Times article, I guess about a year and a half ago, where they did a very close look at the kind of theology of ISIS and the way even things like treating minorities, the way they treat different minorities differently, all very harsh, but some were reserved very harsh treatment more than others. The way that women were treated, who, you know, they raped and are made sexual slaves out of, and so forth. There were even, you know, distinctions there that were can only be understood theologically. Different ones were treated differently according to their religion. And so I think that, you know, political theology can show through in different ways, even though it's entirely true that a lot of the recruits aren't necessarily joining out of a kind of, you know, pervasively theological mindset.
For me, it's a much more almost, you know, very, you know, visceral or gut level thing. They think they're doing the will of God. Yes, they come out of, oftentimes they come out of uneducated and secular backgrounds. They didn't do elaborate theological training in this. But at some point when they go from being just garden variety gang member or thug or alienated teenager or unemployed 20-something-year-old to now strapping on a suicide vest and going out and trying to kill as many women and children and, you know, and innocent men too for that matter as possible and killing themselves in the process, that is not what the vast, vast, vast majority of the world's alienated or unemployed youth do. Okay, so something causes them to cross the threshold, and I think it's believing that there is a supernatural imperative commanding them to do this, and also an eternal state of rewards and punishments that follows. Rewards for following this will, and punishments if you don't. And so it's not necessarily a sociologically textbook definition of religion. They perhaps have, you know, certainly haven't done the Hajj to Mecca before and things like that. But if they think they're doing the will of God, and they tell us that they're doing the will of God, then who are we to say, you just think you're doing the will of God, but that's not your real motivation. It's not rational to blow yourself up. And it's not rational to blow up a lot of other innocent people, too. So something is going on there.
So let me just, we're going to have to end this now. And those of you who still have questions, my apologies. You can come up and ask afterwards. But I just want to try to get particularly Will, but also the others, to talk about whether the United States, and particularly in the State Department, we've hooted and hollered a little bit about the State Department. But it is by law supposed to address this problem, and it has an office and an ambassador and some resources, not enough, but some resources to do this. So how? I mean, is it a matter, let me just throw out a hypothesis, is it a matter of creating religious freedom for Muslims in these societies to read out of their religion this pathology, this ideology? Is it? Does that have anything to do with it? Will, and then Dan, you can say something, Alan, and then we'll end up with you. So.
Yeah, Tom. No, I think that's the fundamental starting point. Is it's got to be. I mean, religious freedom by its nature needs to be universal and inclusive, meaning it's religious freedom for everybody. But the focus here does, I think, need to be religious freedom for Muslims. And then in turn, that creates more space and protection for other religions.
The space Alan was talking about, right? Yeah. Dan, you want to add anything to that?
Sure. Like the State Department strategies.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think we were talking about the realists before. You know, to kind of mainstream religious thinking into our kind of high levels of policy making, you know, much like you've called for in your writings, Tom, where it's not some isolated corner of the State Department, but you've got, you know, high levels of diplomacy. We're realizing that, you know, stability and democracy and peace, which are key to safeguarding various economic interests and so forth, you've got to take the religious factor in the mind, understand what the dynamics are that tend to promote stability and how religious freedom is part of stability, and work with and try to empower those actors and disempower the other ones, but just bring that into the kind of you know, warp and woof of security policy.
That's great. Alan, and then we'll
you know, after the election, I went into my class of 265 mostly freshman sophomore students in American government, and the night before, a couple of Muslim students of mine came up to me, and they said they were afraid. They felt vulnerable. And I felt, in my class, I needed to say, no, that's not who we are here in America, and that we have to affirm the protection, the inclusion, the dignity, the rights of all of our citizens. So to a certain extent, what we do at home, how we are as a society, is a more profound statement than anything else we can do about religious freedom around the world. My second point is that I think we've done a terrible job as a government, a State Department, and not empowering Muslim Americans who are the best ambassadors for an understanding of how Muslims can live full, be better and more authentic Muslims in a society that respects their freedom than societies where the government says you must be a particular kind of Muslim. And I just favor lots of exchanges, whether it's scholar exchanges, student exchanges, diplomatic exchanges, where people from Islamic majority societies and Western societies, especially in the United States, can sort of experience one another's lives, and I just think that you know, I interact with and interview and gotten to know a number of wonderful Muslim leaders and scholars in the United States whose voices are not given the megaphone in some respects that they deserve.
Great, thank you, Alan. Sahara, will you end it up for us?
Yeah, I wanted to kind of push back a little bit on the issue of religion, because, as you stated, 99% of Muslims, 99.9% of the 1.5 billion Muslims are not using violence in the name of their religion. And what we're having is an internal cultural war within the Middle East among Muslim-majority countries or among Muslims as to how to interpret a book that was written, you know, centuries ago. And the same thing could happen to Christianity or Judaism. We can take verses out and we can justify violence. The problem is that you don't have people who are legitimate, including American Muslims. This is the problem with the American Muslims. I cannot go to the Middle East and say, hey, look at me, listen to what I tell you, even if I have an Islamic studies degree, because I'm not legitimate in their eyes. And if I can't effectuate change, then I'm simply an appeaser. I will be the moderate Muslim who will tell them, suck it up and suffer. yes, you're unemployed, yes, you're poor, yes, you've been tortured, yes, your family's in jail, yes, your son has disappeared and you don't know where he is, all of these things, but just suck it up. So my recommendation for policy for the State Department is, if you want to support the debate within Muslim-majority countries and among Muslims about the sabotage of Islam, which is an important debate that needs to be had, you have to make sure that those who are speaking in the name of pluralism and nonviolence can effectuate change. Otherwise, the frustrated will go to the violent people. The travesty of the Muslim Brotherhood failing, and I'm not a Muslim Brotherhood supporter politically, was that they could have been the legitimate Islamists who could have pushed the society into a more pluralistic realm because they had to in order to govern. And then that was going to set an example for the rest of the Middle East, which we had seen Turkey on the way of. And the travesty of Turkey is that they're now regressing back into authoritarianism. So I guess all that is to say that it's very complex, and we need to be thinking about ultimately serving the needs of the people on the ground who are vulnerable to joining these terrorist groups.
Ladies and gentlemen, join me in thanking our panel. Thank you. Terrific.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.